Okay, so I'm going to reward everyone who came on time and punish within an inch of their life those who are coming late by, what should we do? Well, I wanted to start, before I treat you too much to an entertaining PowerPoint, I wanted to just go through preaching. We talked about preaching this morning, didn't we? We said it was fanning the spark in someone's heart until we find a flame. See, this morning, David, we've just been going through what is it we mean when we say devotee. Because I say devotee, and she says devotee, and she says devotee, and we all mean different types of things. We started off with Manoj saying a devotee is someone who follows the four regs, someone who does deity worship, someone else said a devotee is someone who follows Srila Prabhupada's instructions. And I think at that point in the conversation, everybody was a bit worried that they had to give the Prabhupada disciple the right answers, otherwise he would think that they were stupid. But what they didn't realize was how broad the conversation was going. So we talked about devotee being someone who experiences bhakti in the heart, who externally is a part of another religion. Then we defined the mission of Lord Chaitanya, didn't we? We talked about that. That was to spread. Actually, Prabhupada said that to the mission is to increase the family of Krishna within this world. Then we talked what is preaching. Preaching is sometimes a bad word or used in a bad way. What is a preacher? You know. We talked about how we came to Krishna consciousness, didn't we? Some of us, a little bit. Then we said, what is ISKCON? And I asked what seemed to be a very controversial question, David, was how many of you are members of ISKCON? And you should have seen their faces. They really weren't sure whether they wanted to be members of ISKCON or just someone who was dipping their toes into an ISKCON center for a short while to learn something in order to go into the world. But we said that ISKCON, yes, is an institution and an established mission and a legal entity and it has a structure and a system. But really what we're talking about is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which goes beyond any one of those things. And indeed, 96% of our initiated devotees, it seems, do not live in a temple these days, according to the recent figures. So ISKCON can no longer be limited to a confederation of temples, schools, farms, and restaurants that it says in the books. That description of ISKCON is now 20 years old, if not older. It's about time they changed it. Rather, I say, and it's my course, so I can say it. And you can disagree, because you're students, and that's your prerogative. But I say that the smallest unit of ISKCON is the individual leaf on the tree. That was this picture here. The individual leaf on the tree is the practitioner of Krishna consciousness, and the smallest unit of gathering that we have is when two or three people come together to do what? Halakananda. What do they do? What do devotees do when they come together? Before they have prasadam, Sheena? Before they have prasadam? They talk about the Naam, Rupa, Guna, and Leela. They chant Krishna's names. They discuss their relationship to Krishna, the Sambandha. They discuss the Abhideya, the path of getting to Krishna. And they may sometimes discuss Prayojana. They also discuss successful devotees who have achieved their relationship with Krishna. They may discuss failures on the path of devotional service, of which there are many. Some of them are there in the Bhagavatam, some of them are there in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. But from failure normally comes another type of success, because Krishna never leaves a person who has once given himself to him. We talked about oxygen and lungs. We need oxygen, but we need lungs to access them. So a movement is an organ in order to give us the oxygen of spiritual life. It's also an organ to give that spiritual life to others. So oxygen and lungs, they go together, like Belgian pommes frites and mayonnaise. You can't have one without the other. If you have mayonnaise without the pommes frites, it doesn't quite do it. If you have the pommes frites without the mayonnaise, you're missing out. They go together. So an institution for preaching and preaching kind of go together because we need as much help as we can get. Then we talked about how you joined. You told me some interesting stories about how you joined. And then we looked at the tree of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and we talked about the different levels of the movement. And then we went on to this page of definitions there, David. That is on the second page. Some definitions. And I hope you found them helpful. You see, in a course like this, unless we talk definitions, I'll be speaking a different language than you. It's like I'll be speaking Cantonese and you'll be speaking Mandarin. And we just won't know what each one is talking about. Or, because I'm an Englishman of a particular generation, and not this generation, I'll be speaking English and you'll be speaking double Dutch. So let's go on to preaching. I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about how people go on this most mystical of journeys, which leads the soul onwards and upwards towards God. And this is something that's common for all religions. If I was a Russian Orthodox, or if I was a Church of England vicar, or if I was a Jewish rabbi, I'd be saying exactly the same 9 points that I'm going to speak to you now. And then I want to talk about that's preaching on the receiving end, and I also want to talk about preaching on the giving end. Preaching, we've established, is a good word. It's a nice word. It means exhorting people up to a higher level of conduct or a higher level of spirituality. But a preacher should be very careful of not imposing too much on a person who hasn't asked for it, but gently trying to fan the spark which is inside the heart until the spark becomes a flame. Now, if you blow too hard on a spark, you're just going to put the spark out. But if you very, very gently fan it, you see. So that's the point. Many people were initiated before they discovered what the regulated principles were. This one's for you. So I want to talk briefly, and then we're going to have a break, and then I'll show you a little PowerPoint, which will, you know, on a sleepy afternoon, get you going happily. I want to say something that people are on a spiritual search. What this means is that the spirit soul is not happy. The spirit soul is uncomfortable. The spirit soul is looking for something which the soul knows to be its home. We don't find that in the material world. We're looking for it. There's a hunger. There's an appetite for it. I was asked a question today in class. You know, what does a spirit soul do when they want God, but they find a cheater? Instead of a teacher, you just change two letters around and you get a cheater. Huh? Teacher, cheater. Okay. So, cheater. It means someone who wants to take the ambitions of the spirit soul and turn them into something that he or she can enjoy. And that often happens in spiritual life, and often happens in Kali Yuga. We have the situation that the material world's like a forest fire, Davanala, terrible forest fires in Australia. Just a few weeks ago, 200 people died. They were not able to run as fast as they needed to run to get away from the forest fire. Don't know if you've ever seen a forest fire or worse, been in one, but they are very, very terrifying things. Some of our devotees in Sharanagati were running. That's not Sharanagati, but up in Canada, Sharanagati. And the forest fire was coming over the hills. So they said that it's the first time that they really got to understand samsara davanalahara, davanala lidaloka, what it means to be caught in a forest fire. Anyway, the analogy in the Srimad Bhagavatam is that the man runs away from the forest fire and he's burning because the forest fire is at his back. And he wants to find some escape and he jumps into a river. Only after jumping in, finding that it's only a few inches deep, he jumped in with his head first and he cracked his head on the stones which were just underneath the water. So he didn't get relief, but all he got was pain. Now that actually happened to a friend of mine called Bhajanananda. We were having fun one summer on a lake, and what we didn't know was that people had dumped their old cars, they just pushed them off the cliff into the lake. So being brahmacharis, we were all jumping off the cliff down into the water. Unfortunately, he fell onto the top of a car and really hurt himself. I forget whether he dived head first, but no, I hope not. Anyway, the point is that the Bhagavatam uses this analogy for the man who's trying to find a guru in Kali Yuga. And he jumps without first checking how deep the water of satisfaction is, and he bangs his head. So there are a few gurus who can give relief from the forest fire of material existence, but there are even more who want to use the spiritual search, the running away from the forest fire, for their own advantage. Because in this world, if you cannot be Krishna, then be a guru. Because it's the next best thing. Be a preacher. If you really want to be corrupt and enjoy the material world, be a corrupt preacher. Because people will come to you as if you are God. So therefore, it's the best service that you can do for mankind, but it's the most dangerous role to play, because you could deceive yourself and you could deceive others too. But this spiritual search is an innate part of the living being, and this is what brings people through through thick and thin, through all different conditions of life. The next thing people use when they come to Krishna consciousness specifically is that they use their intelligence. They use their intelligence. Intelligence means to be able to process information while holding information that you've already received in your mind. So you compare, you contrast different messages that you've heard previously, you see which ones make sense. And you know, Krishna consciousness does make good logical sense. Up to the point of your disqualification. If you're a pious person and you believe in God, then you'll find Krishna consciousness relatively easy. It's like in Ireland, we had many devotees who came from the Catholic background who understood the position of the priest /guru, who understood the position of ritual, bells, incense, who understood the position of obtaining forgiveness for one's sins, that there was a difference between good deeds and bad deeds in the eyes of God. In other words, they came religiously trained. And to have an image of the Lord or the saints in the temple was easy for them. However, the Protestants found many things difficult. They just found it difficult. The very nature of it was rebelling against authority. There's no priest, no guru. Rebelling against deity worship. You know, that's an innate part of Protestantism, is no deity worship. Rebelling against ritual. And when you grow up with that and you're confronted with all of that in Krishna consciousness, it's not so easy to become acclimatized to it. Now, I came from that background. I came from a background where when you walked into the church, if there was anything more than just plain windows like these and a wooden cross on the wall, that was considered to be, well, we didn't use the term, but Maya. It was considered to be, you know, if there's any decoration of any kind, any smells of any kind. And it was like, I used to live in a village, and most of the people were what they call temperance. Temperance is where you never, you take a vow that you will never touch alcohol. And so even on the very rare occasion when they did a little bit of ritual, which was, you know, Jesus, water turns into wine, you know, the wafer becomes the body of Christ. They just used fruit juice, which is fine for us. It's fine, but there was more what you don't believe than what you do believe. So when those people come to Krishna consciousness, it's easy for them to accept the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, scripture. That's fine. The social gospel. In other words, when some people come to us and they say food for life, most people think that's about as good as it gets, you know, feeding people. But deity worship and God having a form, very, very difficult for a lot of people. Now, for some people it's easy to accept Krishna, because my mother accepted Krishna, my father accepted Krishna, or Ram. Very easy. But he's not the supreme. God has a form, but he has many forms. You know? And so different people will come, and they will proceed with Krishna consciousness up to the level of their disqualification. And the disqualification is often what they had difficulty with in their last life. And you don't know where that person's, and they don't know. So that's the mystery. So it's not uncommon for a person to find it easy to come into Krishna consciousness and then struggle with a seemingly easy, you know, an easy philosophical point, but they can't get over that because there's a blockage there. Something has happened to them in this life. It's just like I came from a broken home. My father left home when I was about 10. I think it's a familiar story with many people in Western Europe. But every time Prabhupada used to say, and Krishna is just like a loving father, I would think to myself, it just went right over my head. Because of my conditioning, that I didn't perceive my father as a loving father. When Prabhupada used that natural example that the father cares for his son and Krishna cares for the living entities, I thought to myself, I'm not sure if I like Krishna. You see, I had to believe in another Krishna. It wasn't the Krishna that was the loving father, but I had to look for another way of believing in Krishna. Do you see what I'm saying? So that was my disqualification. It's not Krishna's fault, you know, but it was just something, it was just my, you know, my inability to accept. So then we use our intelligence and we come up to a certain point and we work with what we've got. Now, some people, they go for many years and, you know, they're actually, they sort of make very slow advancement. And one of the reasons is that what brings people to Krishna consciousness is doubt. They doubt that the world around them is everything that it should be. They doubt that the society that they find themselves in is everything that it should be. When Prabhupada created the Bhaktivedanta Institute, which was for scientific preaching, for devotees that were not preaching philosophy, but they were preaching science, and preaching science, but what you do is you preach. Prabhupada said, he said, the business of the Bhaktivedanta Institute is to create doubt in modern science. He said that's what Bhaktivedanta Institute is meant. So we're not only preaching conviction, surety, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, etc., etc., etc. We're also trying to create doubt in people who say that there is no God. Now, it's sometimes easier to create doubt because we tend to be very doubtful and untrusting creatures anyway. And so someone comes to Krishna consciousness and he kind of doubts his parents. He doubts the school. He doubts the university. He really doubts the politicians. He doubts his, you know, people that are around him. And he thinks, you know, maybe these guys I could trust. Maybe these devotees of Krishna, I could trust them. And then he stays for some time in Krishna consciousness, but he still hasn't given up his doubting tendency. Why? Because doubt brought him into Krishna consciousness. But now he's using it, and he's applying it to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So it is a function of bringing you to Krishna consciousness, and it can help you to move higher. It needs an agency. It needs the preacher to help. It's an important function, but at one point doubt has to be used in a discriminating way. One thing that a person needs to come to on their spiritual journey, and in this we're just talking about the spiritual journey, it could be any religion in the world, any faith, is that a person needs to come to a point of commitment. There's a point of commitment. I think I have a little brochure over here from the Catholic Church that I brought along with me just to show you. We don't have as many spaces as we would like to at Bhaktivedanta Manor for study days and spiritual retreats. So we often borrow a Dominican priory. And this Dominican priory, the sisters are very nice. They're all very nice people, actually. But they gave me this one. And I said, do you have anything about, you know, your journey into faith initiation? So she gave me this one. And it was called Journey into Faith. Hello. And this is called, it's called RCIA, which is recognized all over the Catholic world. 50% of Catholics live in Argentina. And the countries surrounding Argentina, South America is the most Catholic country in the world. It's called the Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults. And what it just means is that it takes a person through the stages of the journey. There is a journey. If as a preacher you don't know the journey that people are on, the tendency is to give them too much too soon or too little too late. You've got to hit it just right. So congregational development, because the bread and butter or the chips and mayonnaise of congregational development is preaching, and chiefly dealing to people who don't have to do what you say because they don't live in a temple. Okay, when you come and you live in a temple, pretty much you have to get up when they tell you to get up. Right, Sheena? Yeah, pretty much you have to go to the program. Why? Because you feel obliged because you're living there and you've chosen to go there. And that's the program in that place. But when people are living in their own home, they don't have to listen to you. So like I was saying this morning in the class, who was there for my class this morning? You were there, okay. The whole point is persuasive speech. Speech that pleases. Speech that brings a smile. These things. All the stuff that I'm not really doing right now. But you've got to be an attractive person. So, anyway, so they go through the stages of faith. I don't even know what's in here, actually. But it's just showing, you know, different people from different countries. These religious books where they send them all over the world in different languages. You've usually got someone from Korea there, and someone from the Philippines here, and someone from Mexico over here, just to show you how international it all is. But really, there is a systematic series of stages bringing you to that point where you get bathed in the water, symbolically the River Jordan, you get the water poured on your head, and you become baptized. So there is a point of there is a point of confirmation. There are many points, actually. And in this book, which I can give you a download of, this is called the ISKCON Small Groups Handbook. I've written the what I think is a sequence of layers that people can go through. And I'm going to show you that on the PowerPoint in a minute. But the whole point is to have... I'm not saying that I'm completely right, but what I will say is that you as a preacher have to discover the main stages that people pass through so that you'll know what you're dealing with. And normally there's a point of investigation, there's a point of doubt, and there's a point of enlightenment, kind of, and then there's a point of commitment. And then from then on, it goes through it again. Investigation, doubt, enlightenment, commitment. And we go all the way through our life like this. And we're always investigating. We're always applying our doubt. Not too much, hopefully. But then at the point of doubt, we get a higher source of information. We get some enlightenment to help us, you know, break through that barrier. And then we come to a point of commitment. And the commitment is, you know, says Sheena at the age of 12, I think I'm going to give up eating meat. You know, Science of Self-Realization that Sheena got when she was 12, such a powerful book. And it was a book that was put together on the advice of an expert who had something to do with Reader's Digest. He said, if you want to make sure that people are reading Swami Prabhupada's books, you have to follow this formula. Nothing more than 3 pages long. It has to be the size that the book has to be the size that a woman can put in her handbag. You have to give introductions that will gently ease people into the discussion. And you have to keep it all very light, nothing too heavy. And so what at the time, the head of the BBT in Los Angeles did was to come up with this book, The Science of Self-Realization, which, I don't know about you, but in England, it has been our, you know, the book that people say, you know, that really got me into Krishna consciousness. Why? Because it's not a canonical text. It's not a scripture. It's Prabhupada just being himself and answering the questions that the reader himself or herself has got. And so here, we see a book that actually does the job. Now, when I worked for 12 years in mail order, we used to measure the number of people responding to our different books. And Science of Self-Realization was always 4 times more than any other Prabhupada book. And yet, at the same time, it is pure Prabhupada. One lady, she became a devotee. She used to joke about the devotees. She used to have a bit of a giggle. She's a middle-aged woman. And what her office colleagues thought that they would do is to wrap up the Science of Self-Realization in Christmas paper and stick it under the office tree. And at the Christmas party, they gave her a present. And she unwrapped the present. And of course, in this polite company, I cannot tell you what words came out of her mouth. So she wasn't very pleased. But anyway, she sort of took it home as a joke that her friends had had a joke with her and she kept it on the shelf. And you know the rest of the story, that one day she picked it up, just like you picked it up. And she looked and she said, hey, you know what, this actually makes sense. And she read it all. And then the point of commitment for her was A, becoming a vegetarian. That's a pretty big thing in people's lives, that they just... Something, to be a more spiritual person, I've got to stop being violent. A lot of people do make that connection. And surprisingly, Indians don't. A Westerner or a European will become a vegetarian first before they take to Krishna consciousness. Whereas an Indian, average, will take to Krishna consciousness, will take to the chanting, without becoming a vegetarian necessarily. It's just people do it. They just do it the other way around. So now, the next stage of commitment will really be, I would think, chanting. Now, what I recommend is that we try and steer a person towards four rounds, something like that. Because four rounds is, I mean, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you know, you chant four rounds as a minimum, and then more according to your taste. That's what he said. And when the Gaudiya Math began, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, he said that those who are renunciates, who are just Babaji's, 64 rounds. Those who are preachers, 16 rounds. And those who are householders, minimum 4 rounds. So that idea was there. Now, of course, Prabhupada wanted to create a preaching society. And pretty much Prabhupada consistently told everybody to chant 16 rounds. However, we do sometimes see that people don't chant 16 rounds. So really, the art of preaching, I would suggest, lies in telling someone to aim for something that is relatively easy to do in the beginning. When you are training a dolphin, you know, to, not that I've trained dolphins, but when they train dolphins to jump out of the water through a hoop, they put the hoop in the water first. The dolphin swims through the hoop, and every time it swims through the hoop, it gets a fish. So the dolphin thinks, aha, hoop, fish, fish, hoop. Got it. Okay. And then they raise it a bit more. So then the dolphin swims by again and thinks, hang on a minute, there was a hoop here. No hoop. Fish? No fish. Okay. Oh, the hoop is above me. Okay. Hoop, fish, fish, hoop. Here I go. And swims through the hoop. Then what they do, the hoop is half in the water and half out of the water. Now at this point, the dolphin has to really use the dolphin's intelligence and think, hang on a minute. Fish, water, hoop, water, fish, hoop, hoop, fish. Okay, got it. But this is something different. This is half hoop, half fish. Let me try. Swim through it. He gets a whole fish. Okay. Now. And he looks around. Where did that hoop go? And he comes out of the water because he wants to eat the fish. He doesn't want to jump through the hoop, people. He doesn't really want to jump through the hoop. He only wants to get the fish. But he knows that the fish is conditional somehow on getting through the hoop first. So even when the hoop is out of the water, he jumps through the hoop and gets the fish. So, but it is in stages. And spiritual life is in stages. And the whole point as a preacher is to be able to help a person to move through those stages. That's what it means.
Is there a stage without fish?
Huh? Is there a stage without gulab jamuns? You always get that reward. Even coming to the temple, we, you know, actually people have to go through the class before they get prasadam, don't they? Normally speaking, there's a little bit of tension in most temples these days if you turn up just for the prasadam. You know, you normally get a bit of a ribbing from the devotees, you know. You miss the class, you miss the kirtan, and you just turned up for the feast. John, I don't think so. Next week you come for the class and you come for the kirtan. That's what it's all about, okay? Yeah, all right. You see? This is a little because devotees know that the feast is a kind of a reward for turning up for the class and the kirtan. But my point here is just to say that there is a... let's say if there's, you know, 8 stages that a person goes through on the way to a commitment... somebody that you're preaching to is going to be on stage 4. Somebody that you're going to preach to is going to be on stage 2. And only one person in the room is going to be on stage 8. So you pitch your class according to the, you know, the majority of people. But when you're dealing with a person individually, you can say, well, this is for you. Don't tell anybody else, but this is something just between me and you. Now, I really think you should go for 8 rounds. You know, you should really try that. Do you think you could try that? Alright, 6. Yeah, okay, 6. And gradually get them involved. Smoking is a big one. But it's not really about getting people to give up. That, those things, once they have this param drishtva, once they have the taste. I never wanted to give up eating meat. I don't think. It was just because the prasadam was so good that it was, it just didn't, you know, I wanted food. That's what I wanted. I wanted good food. And because the prasadam was better than the non-veg, I was all right. So the point of commitment. Commitment means just where they agree to do something and they agree to you or they agree to the community or they agree to just make a promise to themselves. But it's a stage and it's a specified stage and it's just, okay, like this one. With this, the Catholic journey, they do what they call a catechism. A catechism is a one-year journey. Were you a Catholic? You were a Catholic, right? You did a catechism? Must have done.
Yeah, I did lots of things.
Yeah, but you did. So it's a procedure, isn't it? And it you get to the point of making a commitment, a profession of faith, whether it's a baptism or confirmation or first confession or some other thing. But these are important stages. Before you take those stages, there is some fear. There's some fear. There's always some fear. What will I lose if I make this commitment? You know? And what will I gain? And you measure it up like that. And where a person feels fear, they need to be given courage. Now, courage means that their fear isn't taken away, but they feel the fear and do it anyway. So, when you give courage to someone, the English word is encourage. So you encourage a person by giving them courage to take that commitment that they're really a little bit worried about. They may be petrified, they may be just a little bit mildly concerned. A good preacher is a nice preacher, and you know what nice means, don't you? Have you done this one before? A good preacher is a nice preacher. N stands for what are the person's needs. I stands for what are the person's interests. C stands for what is this person's concerns. And E stands for what is this person's expectations. So a good preacher is a nice preacher because he or she thinks of N-I-C-E first and speaks accordingly and acts accordingly. For instance, expectations. Does this person expect me to be acting like this or acting like that? I better make sure that I, you know, behave in a particular way. This person has some concerns that if they come to the Krishna consciousness movement, you know, one of my concerns was I think that when I first came to Krishna consciousness in 1974, we hadn't got the sort of cult thing. It was just before, you know, the notion was around that you know, new religious movements were cults. But still my concerns were there. And they said, oh, you should wait until Prabhupada comes. And I said, how do I know that Prabhupada isn't somebody like Hitler? I actually said that. Can you believe it? How do I know that he's not just somebody like Hitler that's very good at convincing other people of what he wants them to do and that he just hasn't got a whole worldwide movement engaged in doing it for him? How do you know he's the one? How do you know he's... of course... I mean, they were pains to point out that, you know, at no time did Prabhupada say he was the only one. But he was just the person who had come to England at that time through whom Krishna consciousness could be accessed. I had some concerns. And so they took pains to alleviate my concerns by putting my mind at rest. So encouragement means to understand what fear the person has. And if you don't know, ask them. What are you worried about? What does this bring up any concerns for you? Is anything that makes you feel slightly uncomfortable? And you'd be surprised what people tell you. You see? And then you need to give them encouragement. And you need to do it carefully, slowly, like a doctor. Like a careful doctor talks a patient through the problem. Just say, it's all going to be okay. Sorry, you'll be all right. Okay. So this is encouragement. Next one is protection. Put down protection. Once you've got someone who seems to be your friend, who seems to resonate with what you're saying, it's very easy to lose that person if they're unprotected. Now, we find, it's a kind of psychic protection, really, because we find we lose people in the early stages, at least, over Christmas. Christmas, people just go bananas. I don't know what it's like here. Maybe Christmas isn't such a big... Christmas in England is just like, it begins in October and it finishes in January. And it's just, the English, when we drink to excess so that we're falling around in the streets. When we fight, we come over for the football matches, the soccer matches. When we fight, we just fight until we've got broken arms and broken legs. It doesn't seem to be, for some sections of our population, very moderated. Very moderated. So what happens is that people get totally into Christmas, totally into Christmas, and people kind of lose their Krishna consciousness through office parties. They have to drink and they have to dance with people, that they've fancied during the year and they've never got that close to them before. Then they have to give presents, they have to make presents, they have to, all sorts of things. They have to eat more than they normally do, drink more than they normally do, watch more television than they normally do, and go to more parties than they normally do, and really be silly. And we lose people. The other time we lose people is we lose people in the summertime, and they go away for a holiday. Their whole perspective changes. The tensions that they were experiencing that helped to bring them to Krishna consciousness are all gone. They're having a good time. The sun is shining. They're on the beach. I don't need to chant japa. Why? Because I'm already in heaven. See, so we lose people. The other times we lose people are the following. Death of a loved one. These are the big ones. Death of a loved one. Moving house. Really lose people when they move house. It's just Krishna consciousness is the last thing that they pick up. It's just, people have a tendency to compartmentalize religion. So they give up being a Catholic on a Sunday, and then they put Hare Krishna on a Sunday, go to the temple. And then when they move house, there's so much to do with your Sundays for at least another 5 months that you don't even think of going to the Hare Krishna temple. Why would you? Everything's in boxes, you need to unpack, you need to decorate, you need to paint, you need to clean, you need to tidy up the garden. And we lose people for five months at a time. So did I say death of a loved one?
Why death of, doesn't that Krishna consciousness
It should do, shouldn't it? But people seem to become distracted by it. Sometimes the distraction is so much that it distracts them from the very neophyte practices. They've just started chanting Hare Krishna. Or sometimes they can be chanting for a long time. And it does happen. Sickness is a big one. When they have personal sickness. So death of someone, sickness, moving house, losing their job, or money worries. Now you could say, money worries brings people to Krishna consciousness. Yes, it does. But when they get the money worries after they've come to Krishna consciousness, it can actually take them away again. Death of a loved one can bring a person to Krishna consciousness, but after they've come to Krishna consciousness, death of a loved one can take them away. And the other thing is divorce. Not just divorce, but these days, because people don't get married even, they just live together. So breaking of a relationship, boyfriend, girlfriend. And the most difficult thing we have is that people, boy comes to the temple, girl comes to the temple. Did your father ever do that? Fly away, Peter, fly away, Paul. Did they do that? Do that in South Africa?
My brother did.
Yeah? Two little dicky birds sitting on the wall. One called Peter, one called Paul. Fly away, Peter, fly away, Paul. You know that? Okay. So here comes... young man into Krishna. Young girl into Krishna. Come to the temple. They see each other across a crowded temple room. Something happens. A little bit of pixie dust is sprinkled. A little bit of Cupid's arrow. And they swap telephone numbers and they enter into a relationship. They come to the temple, and every time they come to the temple, their eyes are sparkling. Why? Because they're in love. And they also have Krishna, and Krishna introduced them, and the world is perfect. They got the right God, he got the right girl, she got the right boy, they're both vegetarian. He's so nice because I always wanted a spiritual type guy. He's got the girl, I always wanted a really spiritual girl who's a vegetarian. Hey, this is fantastic. Krishna consciousness is great. What happens next? Fly away, Peter, fly away, Paul. So what happens then is, of course, just as they fall into love, they fall out of love. Just something happens. Could be anything. In Krishna consciousness, you know, it's normally wrapped in a Krishna conscious type thing, or not. And they fall out of love. He stops coming. She stops coming. She stops chanting. He stops chanting. Why? It doesn't make any sense. It only makes emotional sense. But that's what you're dealing with as a preacher. You're dealing with people's emotions. Emotions are not logical. They're emotions. That's why they're different from mental reasoning. That's why they go on, they affect different parts of the brain. All these are emotional responses to pain. So divorce, money, sickness, death, moving house, holidays, or birth of a child. I could send you spinning for at least 3 years. So, do you remember what I was saying when I said that broadcasting Krishna consciousness, I gave the story about Jesus, you would have liked this one, being raised as a Christian, I showed three stones, I had them here, you missed it all, I had three stones on a plate, one was orange, it was from Jerusalem, one was creamy color from the Sea of Galilee, right at the spot where Jesus walked on water, and one was from near Cana, where he turned water into wine. I had them all on a plate and I passed them around. Everybody was looking, oh, I wonder what this is. And Jesus was saying that Jesus was standing in one spot where all the different colored rocks came together. And he said, you know, sometimes when you cast your seeds, they fall on places where nothing happens. Sometimes plants grow, and sometimes they kind of half grow, but they're weak. So when we broadcast Krishna consciousness, it's like throwing seeds out. We're doing Harinam. Is it preaching? Yes. But is it broadcasting? Most definitely. Book distribution, festivals, Rathayatra. We're dealing with hundreds of people at a time. This sort of preaching that I'm talking about is not broadcasting. It's specific one-to-one, one-to-two, one-to-three, or six people in a room. It's small numbers of people. You're helping them forward with their spiritual life. Me? Help someone forward with their spiritual life? I'm just trying to help myself forward with my spiritual life. Unfortunately, in the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, everyone has to be a guru at the same time as being a shishya. You have to be both. You see? Just like I'm a father, I have three children, but I'm still a son. My mother will never see me as a father. My mother will always see me as a little boy. But my little boy will never see me as a little boy. He'll always see me as daddy. But the point is, I have to be both. I have to be a son, and I have to be a father at the same time. You see? So you have to be a guru, and you have to be a shisha. You have to be a student at the same time. When you preach, you're a guru. When you do the things that a disciple does, you're a disciple. So when you have a group of people and you're looking after them, you become the guru. Not the ISKCON guru or the ISKCON initiating guru or the Diksha or the this or that or the other, whatever name we may wish to give it. But it's guru because you're passing on the message of Krishna. And anybody who repeats what Krishna said on the battle of Kurukshetra battlefield, that person's guru. And that's your responsibility. Now, so we talked about protection. So understand when these things are coming and give them protection. The other thing is a sense of belonging. Devamrita Swami is very successful in his Loft program in Australia and New Zealand. And he talks a lot about the main motivation of people coming is because they're lonely, but a lonely person will never admit it. Nobody wants to be known as a lonely person. You can have lots of friends, but still be lonely. Loneliness is to do with not knowing why you feel lonely, not knowing why you feel the way that you do. It's a sense of disconnectedness. And a person can be living in a cave and not meeting another human being, from week to week, and not feel lonely. Or a person can be in the middle of a crowded city and feel completely lonely. So these are often the people that sometimes come to, and it's a spiritual loneliness ultimately, isn't it? A sense of angst, sense of existential anxiety. I'm connecting. I'm not where I need to be, somewhere else, and I'm not sure where that somewhere else is. And then they start looking. So one of the places they look is the Loft centers, so-called, because I guess it's at the top of a building. It used to be in a converted loft. So they do a yoga. You know the score, don't you? They do a yoga, yoga lessons, and then at the weekend they do the traditional Hare Krishna Sunday feast. But the Loft is not a temple most of the time. In other words, there's doors that cover up the, Panchatattva or the Gauranitai. And they create a lounge setting where people can come to be friends with each other. I'll shock you now with another statistic. This statistic, the number of people, the percentage of people who join a religious movement because a friend was already involved. Give me a figure. 85%. In a survey in America, 85% of people say they joined a spiritual group because a friend was already involved. Now this is very interesting. I'm going to keep coming back to this. But because of even Prabhupada came to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, he did not want to go. But he said, my friend Narendranath Mullock, he pulled me by the elbow. So if Prabhupada's life is a sort of template for other people's lives coming to Krishna consciousness, we can take that as a common factor, that people come because they know someone who's involved. How many times do people come to the temple when they're in twos? They don't come alone, they come with another friend. So the opposite of loneliness is the sense of belonging. Loneliness is the sense that you don't belong anywhere, or you don't belong to anyone. And it's very, very common in Kali Yuga. Very, very common in modern cities in Kali Yuga. and very common in young people in cities in Kali Yuga. So you could say that ISKCON is interested in such people, because young people have a tendency to sometimes dramatically change their life or to pick up new habits at a certain point in their life. Whereas the older you get, the less you change dramatically. So certainly an audience for ISKCON is people like that. But you know, whatever the age and wherever they live, a sense of belonging is very important. You know, and if people feel that they don't belong in ISKCON, then they usually don't stay very long, do they? You know, I don't really feel I belong here. Why would you stay? You just go and find someone that you belong with, which usually means finding someone that you can belong to, which usually means a one-to-one romantic relationship where you feel that you can totally belong to that person, or they can totally belong to you. And you can end up even lonelier, because that sort of belonging doesn't satisfy the spiritual need to belong. So this sense of belonging, and there's 85% of people who come because they, you know, a friend that they already belong to got them into it. I'll keep coming back to that, because there's a process by which you can reverse that, and you can actually create the sense of friendship in order to, you know, make people feel a sense of belonging quicker than natural. I want to say something, I want to say one more thing, two more things, and then we'll stop. I want to talk about Friends. Friends. Not the TV series with Jennifer Aniston.
Hey!
But Friends, I mean, the reason why that series became very popular was, of course, because people liked the idea of just kind of friends hanging out together in a bunch of flats, bunch of apartments. People really want to be with people who are like them. And, you know, the nuclear family has been changed somewhat. People don't just go from school to college to marriage to home and family. What they do these days is there's a big bit in between where they, you know, they sort of deal with many different friends. And these friends don't have to be people who they have sexual relationships with, but they can be people who just, they just can really open up in their company and like that. But people really need a person who can be a friend, which is slightly different from the sense of belonging, but it's got a lot to do with the sense of belonging. And it's a certain sense of intimacy. It's a certain sense that this person accepts me for what I am. And sometimes with preachers, they don't let you alone long enough to allow you to feel that you're okay being who you are. And that's an important thing. That as much as you're trying to help a person to move forward in spiritual life, you've also got to allow them the space to feel comfortable in being who they are right now. And sometimes you're not quite sure, you know, what's what. You're not quite sure how to deal with it. And finally, things I put in here are that a person must have mystical experiences. Mystical experiences. Things, coincidences, revelations, little enlightenments that just seem to come from somewhere that's not, you know, it's not really, it wouldn't have happened that way under normal circumstances. Something else is going on here in my life that, or a mystical experience in the sense that, you know, the sky opened up and a shaft of sunlight came and illuminated my face, and at that moment I just knew that Krishna was God. Or, you know, I chanted four rounds for 6 months and I just thought, let me do this, let me chant five rounds. And I chanted five rounds and the ecstasy, I mean, my whole body was shivering when I chanted the last bead of the fifth round. Tears came to my eyes and my Guru Maharaj walked in and I thought, oh, I just just want to surrender. I just want to be a devotee forever. That sort of experience. People need something like that out of the ordinary to be able to say, you know, this is out of the ordinary. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to stop there and we're going to carry on a little bit longer. I told you this day I'm working you the hardest. It gets easier after today. All right. Are you okay so far? Mm-hmm. Okay, so, okay. Because I'm fresh, you see. Because we are fresh. And then tomorrow I have to keep it going with games and puzzles and slideshows and different things. All right, so we take a 10-minute break here. Come back at 1:45. 9-minute break.
I'm sorry for coming late. I speak with you.
You'll have to make it up to me somehow.
I'll bring you a...
No, I think what we're going to do as a punishment is if you come late, you have to dress as a ballerina, and you have to dance on top of the table.